You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Good morning, everyone. You are listening to Green Left Radio, your breakfast team every Friday. We are coming to you live from 3CR. 8:55 a.m. on your dial. And yeah, thank you for joining us. I'm one of the hosts, Chloe, and I'm joined by Steph and Jacob in the studio. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning, yeah. Everyone. It's been a number of weeks since I've been on the program.
Well, yeah, you've been off gallivanting and you know, globetrotting, Jacob.
Yeah. I was away in Malaysia and Singapore, but then I also went away to New South Wales for a week and a half to attend the Rising Tide blockade, which we interviewed Zebedee Parks last Friday about. And we also have actually a new article up on Green Left for people who want to kind of hear all about the Rising Tide blockade that happened over the weekend.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And then you went off to the Blue Mountains. And anyway, welcome back. It's good to have you back. Mm. Yeah. Maybe before we go any further, and now I've said that, my computer is not cooperating. So I'm just going to freestyle this. But Green Left Radio and 3CR would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and we acknowledge the ongoing impacts of genocide on First Nations people all around the world. And to any First Nations people who may be listening, we acknowledge you. And yeah, we acknowledge that this is stolen land, always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
Okay, so just to announce what we have coming up on our program this week. This is going to, just for listeners' information, this is probably going to be the second last live-to-air program we do before we go on a break for summer programming. But there's still a lot happening in politics, you know, pretty much every day. In fact, actually, there is a sort of extra story that if we have time to talk about, I just read it in the Herald Sun this morning, but it's kind of amusing.
Oh,
but
boy.
Okay. It does relate to the first sort of headline news story we're going to talk about, like it's vaguely connected. But just to announce what we have coming up on our program, we'll have a bit of headline news discussion at the start for the first 15 minutes or so, then we'll play a song. Then we'll have Isaac Nellis, who's a member of Social Alliance and journalist for Green Left, to actually discuss how Labor has paved the way for One Nation's rise in support. Then after that, we'll be drawing on some international news from the pages of Green Left. We'll be looking at the recent protests by Italian dock workers against the genocide in Gaza. We'll be talking about the Your Party conference that happened in Britain. And then we'll also be talking about some other kind of news stories, depending on how much time we have. Then around 8:10 a.m., we're going to be having an interview with Lara regarding the Techno Park win. This is an ongoing campaign that Green Left Radio has actually been covering for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And it's actually great to kind of hear that there has been a victory for that campaign.
Yep.
Then we'll be going through the Green Left activist calendar and so on. So, yeah, we have, as we sort of mentioned, we have quite a packed program this week.
Yep.
But maybe I'll go start off with a bit of a headline news discussion. The most kind of important kind of news story that's kind of happened in the past week. And this is, and basically the report is that the United States has seized an oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela, and this is in the context of President Donald Trump, from the Trump administration, has essentially been threatening military action against Venezuela for the last several months. Now, essentially, there has been an operation led by the Trump administration, basically taking this vessel from the Venezuelan government, and really, I mean, I think this has to be condemned in the highest kind of terms. Essentially, we are in a situation where the government of the United States can actually just get away with what it wants. It can basically do anything under the pretense of fighting drug trafficking in quotes. But really, I mean, we have to point out that this assault on Venezuelan sovereignty is not about drug trafficking. It's not about human rights protection. Really, it is about, you know, the United States asserting its hegemony against Latin America. Because at the end of the day, you know, the United States has treated Latin America like it's backyard. You know, for the exploitation of multinational corporations and among other things. And I think, you know, this is, you know, also shows the kind of increasing danger of the Trump administration and the possibility of military action being taken against Venezuela is very real. And I think, you know, we have to extend all the solidarity to Venezuela, especially the Venezuelan people who are facing, you know, these real direct threats to their sovereignty. But yeah, does any of the other presenters want to sort of have any kind of comments you'd like to raise on this story?
Yeah, well, we can see the US has military impunity, and the Australian government absolutely supports that. They support the US war drive. And the ALP, we've seen the ALP, they've just been silent about the latest US aggression against Venezuela, and they've said nothing about the US respecting that national sovereignty. Yeah. And it's important that we resist Trump's war against Venezuela and the whole of Latin America, really, and build a really strong movement to defend it and to support any hands-off Venezuela actions, solidarity actions. There's been a few initiated by Venezuela Solidarity Campaign. And as part of those actions, we need to keep demanding that the Australian government call on the US to stop military intervention and those threats to Venezuela, Colombia, Mexico. These are all oil-rich and anti-imperialist countries, and they're countries who don't support Israel in their genocide of the Palestinian people, because, you know, Venezuela and Colombia have been very critical of U.S. policies in the Middle East and the U.S. support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. So it is very important that we stand with the people of Latin America and the Caribbean, and this US aggression has been really building up for more than 20 years. The US has been trying to overthrow the government of Venezuela, which was led by President Hugo Chavez from 1999 until his death in 2013, and it's now led by Nicolas Maduro. And you know, we've heard that the US has imposed these crippling sanctions that affect the people of Venezuela. The US has supported attempted coups. It's supported an economic blockade that's trying to prevent the Venezuelan government from participating in international trade. And these blockades, they undermine the healthcare system. They make it difficult to get medicines and vaccines and equipment. The US has sent warships and planes and soldiers ready to attack Venezuela. And we did hear about a few months ago that the US Navy just sunk these seven small boats in the Caribbean near the Venezuelan coast, and they killed 30 people. And recently they sank two boats off the coast of the Colombia's Pacific coast. And yeah, like Jacob was saying, Trump's just claiming these were drug smugglers, even though there's no evidence, and that's not really a justification to murder people anyway. Even if the US suspected the boats were carrying drugs, it could have just stopped the boats and searched them if that's what they wanted to do. Instead, they chose to sink them and murder all the crew.
Yeah.
And like, we got to ask, why is the US doing this? What's the motive? There are lots of different motives, but one's economic. The US wants to control the natural resources of Latin American countries, like the Venezuela oil. The US wants to install governments that would follow a pro-foreign, US foreign policy. And they've always wanted to crush any moves towards progressive social change in Latin America. So, for example, Chavez used to use Venezuela's oil wealth to fund free healthcare. And the US ruling class saw this as a bad example because, you know, it might inspire people to rise up in the US and demand free healthcare. So the Venezuelan people, they are preparing to resist this latest US aggression, and many are joining the militia to fight a potential US invasion. So we do stand with the people of Venezuela, and yeah, long live the Venezuelan resistance.
Yeah, yeah, it's a real escalation. It's also piracy. Like, you can't it's mind-boggling that they're getting away with this. But it's no surprise. It's like a long trend of, like you said, US interference and attempts to control and subvert Venezuelan independence and autonomy. We might move to another. I'm really sorry, listeners. Oh, sorry.
I was going to say, we can read more articles and information about this at LINX, the International Journal of Socialist Renewal, and also Green Left.
And there's some really great podcasts and recordings, including from the Rising Tide blockade. There's some interviews there with Ben, who's one of our members and was a journalist and living actually in Latin America for the last little while. So he's got like an on-the-ground sense of what's happening over there. So make sure to check that out. Sorry, listeners, it's a bit doom and gloom to start with. We will have some better news later on. But unfortunately, we've got another grim story here with Aboriginal deaths in custody has actually increased. It's probably the most... just heartbreaking thing to hear. So the Australian Institute of Criminology released a report on December the 10th showing that over 2024 to 2025, 33 First Nations people died in prison custody, police custody and custody-related operations and youth detention, which is the highest number since 1979 to 1980. Yeah, I'm pausing there for effect because I think that needs to sink in. Like, it's horrific. Sorry, Chloe, did you want to?
That's appalling. It's, here at Green Left, we support the abolition of prison, and the prison system is, you know, remember that it's a direct legacy and an ongoing tool of colonization used by imperial powers to control and to extract labor from colonized peoples, especially indigenous groups. And there's lots of this process of colonization and dispossession of all First Nations people. It's meant so much intergenerational trauma and loss of so many things like language and land and so much displacement. And then that legacy, together with this continuing institutionalized racism that we see within the prison system, it's resulted in more health problems, massive imprisonment rates, and shorter life expectancy. Indigenous people can expect to live like 8 to 9 years less than non-Aboriginal people in this country. And there are lots of human rights abuses taking place in youth detentions that mainly impact and target Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and people. So, and it must be bad if right now the new Northern Territory government are blocking the United Nations inspectors from visiting the prisons and the watch houses. There is an article about that in Green Left. We've also seen the increasing privatisation of the prison system, which means there's a profit motive behind throwing people behind bars, which
is
pretty scary. Yeah. And crime rates, I was reading something that Lydia Thorpe said about crime rates of the countries that are investing in the community and dismantling prisons, such as Scotland. The crime rates are falling in those countries.
Of course, because most offending... for the working class is, unsurprisingly, poverty-related. Who knew that? Yeah. Oh, sorry, that's being sarcastic. Of course, it's poverty-related. But, I found this is really interesting too. And this will probably come as no surprise to listeners, but unfortunately this report comes 34 years after the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, which handed down 339 recommendations to stop such deaths, most of which have not been fully implemented.
Yeah, and I just want to kind of I thought some of the comments that Lydia Thorpe made were quite good, because there's a, when it comes following on from that point about the recommendations, one of the excuses that the federal government often makes is that the whole issue of state of deaths in custody is actually a state and territory issue. But really, the as Lydia kind of says, we cannot really accept this. The federal government could actually step in and pull the states and territories into line to stop these deaths. The Commonwealth, as Lydia points out, has the constitutional power to legislate national minimum standards across the criminal legal centre, legal system. Yet the Albanese government refuses to kind of act. But also, I think when you look at what the different kind of states are kind of doing, I mean, especially when you look at the Northern Territory, Victoria and Queensland, the issue of law and order is often used as a bit of a wedge issue in terms of ensuring that political power and also kind of the narrowing of debate within the electoral sphere. You know, so essentially we live in a world where politicians are essentially playing with people's lives and having a debate about, you know, how hard can we lock up people? And this is all at the expense of First Nations people. I'd also add one thing as well that, I mean, yeah, I think the Scotland experience is definitely useful, but I also think one thing that's specifically unique to Australia is obviously the history of colonisation. Like the fact that these deaths in custody, it's happening is very much just a reflection of the ongoing colonial nature of the Australian state and the policies that it implements that disproportionately impact on First Nations people.
Yeah, just as most health and social issues disproportionately impact on Aboriginal people, whether it's family violence or sexual assault or incarceration, or homelessness. Yeah.
All right.
Shall we go to a quick break and maybe a song?
I think we might need a break and maybe a song just to pick the mood up a little bit. It's very grim stuff, and it's also something that we need to just sit with as well. I'm really glad that we're having this discussion. I'm really grateful that these reports are being released, and I hope to God that the changes are implemented, and we need to demand that they are.
Well, here is a song to cheer you up by Chilean protest rapper Portavoz. His song, I Write Rap With R for Revolution.
Yeah. Explode that. Para que tomen, para que tomen conciencia. Hoy dejo los reclones, mis cojones y no hay vuelta. Me escurro entre las grietas del muro que deja en tu cabeza la ideología burguesa con su puta prensa. Quieren callarme, pero nací gritando. Y una vez que los ojos abren, ya no sabes cerrarlo. En un país donde si el pobre roba, la gana lo espera. Y si lo hace un empresario, claro, llega la moneda. Mi texto es político, de un contexto político, creado por decisiones políticas. Significa que si mi rap es político, no es porque crean políticos, es porque tengo mi propia opinión y visión crítica. Simple la conclusión del tema. Si no eres parte de la solución, te haces parte del problema. Hacer rap para alucinar y denigrar a la mujer, o para contar la realidad y
rebelarse contra el poder.
Yo soy quien prendió fuego a tu ego, así que atento escuchen, pa' que el gobierno no culpe luego al pueblo mapuche. Soy quien subvierte el lenguaje, me que trefe en un paisaje de frases con más montaje que Hitler.
sigue dura, mi postura firme contra esta dictadura que te anula y te hace jurar que eres libre. Este es el camino que sigo, no hay que me detenga. Tendrás que taparme a tiros como a Rodrigo Cisterna. Y en cualquier lugar que venga la muerte, bienvenida sea mi dejarse que a mi gente. Prepárate, organízate y levanta la frente. Identifica al enemigo, el futuro es el presente. Y en cualquier lugar que venga la muerte, bienvenida sea mi dejarse que a mi gente. Entre tanta telecompetición y reggaetón, yo escribo rap con R de revolución. Es cierto ser un revolucionario, mi proyecto, pero soy humano con defecto para igual que el resto. También estoy dominado, pero a pesar de esto no me he conformado, puesto que me paro y lo intento. Ya no hay moderación, yo voy por la liberación. La alteración de la sociedad entera es la operación. Generación que no espera aviso de nadie, que sabe que cambios reales se hacen sin permiso y en la calle. Y no te hablo de copete, güey, y vacilón, simplemente porque de carrete ya habla reggaetón. Prefiero hacerle frente a los medios de comunicación, contándole a mi gente como miente la televisión. Yo también pienso por mí mismo y creo que el relativismo no sirve para nada, nos deja donde mismo. Por eso me defino, voy contra el capitalismo y grito, quiero poder popular y sigo firme y digno y digo, tú no harás que yo calle, ni los pagos me toman, tú no harás que yo pare, mejor que me lo coma, porque esta es mi misión, mi vocación, definición, contribución, mi posición. Y está claro, rapeamos con los pies en el barrio y ya, no hacemos rap al pueblo, somos el pueblo haciendo rap. Y no vale una amiga lo que diga a todo el mundo, si los perros chillan significa que les pica el punto. Se viene el tiempo duro y hay distintos rumbos, yeah. Esta es mi trinchera, estas son mis cartas en el asunto. Traigo bombas de rima al campo de batalla, Vengo a contarte un poco lo que otro rapero se calla, sí. Y en cualquier lugar que venga la muerte, bienvenida sea mi dejarse que a mi gente. Prepárate, organízate y levanta la frente. Identifica al enemigo, el futuro es el presente. Y en cualquier lugar que venga la muerte, bienvenida sea mi dejarse que a mi gente. Entre tanta telecompetición y reggaetón, yo escribo rap con R de revolución.
Déjeme decirle algo, aunque le pueda parecer ridículo. Un revolucionario verdadero está guiado por grandes sentimientos de amor. Amor a la humanidad, amor a la justicia y a la verdad. Es imposible pensar en un revolucionario auténtico sin esta cualidad.
You're back listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR, and you were just listening to a song by Portavoz. His song I write rap with R for Revolution.
So we now have our first interview for the program. Now we're very happy to be joined today by Isaac Nellis. Isaac is a member of Socialist Alliance and a regular writer for Green Left. And Isaac has recently written an article commenting on the rise of One Nation, but also analysing how, you know, the kind of policies of the Labor government has very much paved the way for One Nation's rise and support. I think for a lot of our listeners, you're probably aware that recent polls in the news have actually shown that One Nation's support has actually increased from like 10 to 12 to 15 kind of percent. And this has also probably been the context in which former Nationals leader Barnaby Joyce has actually made the decision to jump ship to One Nation, probably suspecting, given the kind of disarray of the Liberal Party, that he actually stands a chance of, you know, potentially being able to gain a seat. And he is going to be slated to run as a New South Wales Senate candidate when the next election kind of rolls around. We'll go unpack some of this with Isaac. So good morning, Isaac.
Good morning, Jacob. Good morning, Chloe and Steph and 3CR listeners.
Hey, comrade.
Hello.
So, Isaac, I guess I want to kind of start off. So I just mentioned the kind of surge in support for One Nation. And I guess, what do you think are some of the kind of reasons for this?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty scary, right? Like, this is their highest level of support in something like 27 years, back when they were first kind of starting off in the late 90s. So it is worth interrogating why this is happening. think the most kind of obvious and probably a big chunk of what the growth in support is the disgruntled kind of coalition voters who are looking for somewhere to be after what's been a pretty disastrous kind of federal election result and subsequent kind of year for particularly the Liberal Party, who kind of unable to present a feasible kind of alternative to Labor. And there's been long-standing kind of divides within the Liberals, where there's the more kind of right-wing versus far-right kind of factions. So I think that kind of layer is probably reflected in Barnaby Joyce jumping from Nationals to One Nation, where they want to actually have a more strongly kind of cohered kind of far-right party. And the other layer is probably the far-right kind of consolidating around One Nation. So, you know, every election there's always a whole bag full of far-right micro-parties that contest on various, racist or, homophobic or whatever platforms they have. So, we've had, Trumpet of Patriots last election. There's been United Australia Party, Family First, etc. So I think part of this represents some of those smaller groups kind of electing to kind of, or the voters for those smaller parties electing to kind of gather around One Nation as a kind of figurehead for that the movement. And I think this is partly inspired by the far right success in Europe and the United States, where they've been able to kind of gain some momentum electorally as well. And I think the other element is that there is this level of frustration with the capitalist system and the kind of status quo of rich getting richer, poor getting poorer. People are really feeling pain of housing crisis and the cost of living. And I think the far right has been quite successful in capturing, some of that feeling and directing it towards, their agenda. And as you mentioned, that's been driven by the role of Labor in government, who are pretty much killing off hope for real change, and they're continuing the program that they started in their first term in power of lowering expectations and ruling, on behalf of the capitalist class and the rich. So I think all those factors combined have given One Nation a big boost in the polls that we've seen.
So I want to kind of hear a bit of comments from you, Isaac, on the Labor government's second term, and very much, have they kind of delivered it all for working people?
Well, a short answer, no. But, they won this huge majority in the last federal election. There was celebrating all around the country. People were thinking, what are they going to do with this kind of position? But they refused to use that position to deliver any serious reforms on the big social issues. So the things that they have introduced have mainly been kind of tinkering around the edges of issues, or these kind of big name ideas like the social media ban that just went into place for under 16s. That they're this kind of big idea that doesn't actually address any of the kind of key issues. So another example is the housing policy that they've released. Is actually just making housing more expensive and putting first home buyers into more debt. The environment law changes that passed a week or two ago. The Greens were able to improve them very slightly, but at the end of the day, they failed to address the elephant in the room, which is the fossil fuel driven climate change. And then they're pushing ahead with things like the AUKUS military alliance with the US, which is costing more than $400 billion, which is a pretty unimaginable amount of money, and actually requires shifting a whole bunch of our kind of economy and workforce towards propping up militarism. And that's instead of addressing the real emergency, which is climate change. And then they're still handing out $15 billion in subsidies to fossil fuel companies, it's still sending weapons to Israel as it commits its genocide in Gaza. And I think the other important issue is the way that Labor kind of keeps workers and the union movement on a leash and stops it from taking meaningful action to protect workers' rights or increase wages and working conditions, etc. And that that attack on the CFMEU is pretty outrageous, and it defanged one of the few unions that were willing to take action. So I think this is a huge part of why billionaires have been able to keep ripping workers off, not giving us wage rises, and because of people feeling this pain is why they're looking for alternatives, and some of those people are looking, you know, to the far right and to One Nation. And I think it's no surprise that people are pissed off with this Labor government.
All right. So the next kind of question is, one of the kind of things that One Nation has really been able to tap into is this kind of argument that's getting increasingly popularized, that when it comes to the housing crisis, immigration is the cause. And why does the left need to kind of reject these arguments, and why, and what are the arguments that we need to be making to reject this narrative?
Yeah, it's been the huge argument pushed by the far right around the world, that we've seen that immigrants are basically to blame for the housing crisis or for, you know, healthcare shortages, et cetera, et cetera, you name it. I think the first reason to oppose these arguments is because they're not true, and they're basically a big lie, a big scam to trick working people. But if you look at the housing construction versus immigration rates in the past 10 years, there's been more homes built than immigrants arriving. Actually, an interesting stat is that population growth in Australia is at its lowest since the Great Depression in the 1930s. So the fact that of population growth, it should be the main driver of shortage of house prices, but it's very low, and house building is outpacing it. But there's been a historic trend of anti-immigration fears kind of rising when there's periods of economic recession or rising unemployment. So I think that's tied in with that, where that's coming from. And it's interesting as well, we actually have a shortage of skilled workers, particularly in construction. So we need more immigrants to build more homes. It is part of the kind of economic narrative as well. But yeah, I guess it's immigrants are a useful scapegoat for, you know, the media, the right-wing politicians to blame, so that the real cause of the housing crisis is examined, which is that housing has become one of the most surefire ways to get a return on your investment. So there's these investors and mega landlords investing huge amounts of money in the property market and, you know, leveraging the investor-friendly kind of negative gearing and capital gains tax exemptions and drawing out huge profits. And this is from something that should be, you know, a human right, a basic that everyone should have access to, is being used as a massive rort for you know, the rich to make more and more money. And that includes leaving some of these properties empty so that they can continue to make money from them while they're just sitting empty. And that's why there's so many empty properties in a lot of the major cities. It also distracts from lack of public housing. We used to build about 20% of all new housing used to be public housing, and now it's down a tiny percentage. So a lot of the new housing that is being built is, you know, aimed at richer people, these fancy multi-million-dollar apartments, etc. So that means there's less, you know, homes available that people can actually afford. And it's part of the tricky part of it is that Labor doesn't actually want to reduce house prices, because there's about 12 million people who own property, and they've been told for decades that this is the surefire way to ensure that you have a comfortable retirement. You know, this should carry you out, and you can pass this on to your children, etc. So a lot of people who don't want house prices to fall because they've spent their whole working lives investing in it. So for Labor and government, it's easier for them to go along with this idea that immigrants are to blame than it is for them to actually address the root causes of the housing crisis. And so that's one reason, I guess. And then the other reason is because we have to oppose the racism and prejudice that is built into the blaming of immigrants as well. And I think, you know, this country's got a history of being built on genocide of First Nations people, you know, and that's continuing to this day. I just heard you were talking about this, the deputy custody stats before this. And then, you know, the White Australia policy, which the kind of latest expression of that being the bipartisan Stop the Boats campaign, which demonized refugees. So this kind of racism that's been embedded in society over decades and centuries, this kind of outburst against immigration is part of that. And that's something we have to challenge.
All right. So thanks for that response, Isaac. I mean, I think it is very kind of important, you know, that we actually raise these kind of arguments because, I mean, I think it's very important to point out that, you know, essentially both the Liberal Party and the Labor Party have actually normalised this argument, this right-wing argument that's very much been pushed by the far right, that mass immigration is the cause of the housing crisis. And I think, yeah, it's also been a very big trend in all parts of a lot of parts of Western Europe and in the United States. Now, the kind of final kind of question I want to sort of ask you and is what are the kind of socialist solutions that are kind of needed to challenge One Nation and the major parties?
Well, yeah, I think socialists are actually in a pretty good position to be well equipped to challenge One Nation and the far right fear-mongering and hate because, you know, we can actually point to and explain the source of the pain and the crushing of people's dreams. We can say, you know, it's not immigrants, it's not renewable energy, it's not, you know, First Nations people, but it's actually the billionaires, the super rich and the capitalist system that serves them. So instead of just tinkering around the edges in the way that Labor does, they can actually point to a root cause and explain why people are feeling the way they're feeling. So the far right kind of prey on social isolation, economic insecurity, and people feeling powerless and left behind by politics. They manipulate these kind of the genuine distress that people feel to drive their racist agenda. So if we actually address some of these issues, help people fight for, you know, economic security, help give people a voice and a say in politics and in how the world works, in their day-to-day lives, that can kind of take the oxygen away from, you know, the Pauline Hansons of the world. So socialists can provide these concrete solutions that, you know, point to people's everyday concerns, but then also point to the longer-term system change that's also needed. Now, you know, there is a lot to be angry about because we do live in a system that rips off working people to profit a tiny few who control our economy. So socialists can, you know, harness that frustration and anger that people are feeling and direct it towards the real villains, you know, the billionaires and their, you know, servants in Parliament, Labour and the Coalition, rather than it being directed against, you know, immigrants, minorities, the poor. It's hard for Labour or, you know, it's hard for Labor to challenge the far right because they don't want to challenge capitalism, so they don't have anywhere to go. They can't kind of explain. There's no kind of option for them there, whereas socialists can. Not to say it's an easy thing to do. I mean, it's going to be a challenge to address this rise of the far right, and it's been seen around the world. I think a starting point is to link up the struggles for workers' rights with the movements against racism, against war, and for justice for First Nations people. I think social solutions, you know, redistributing wealth, ensuring decent living standards for all, they are actually gaining momentum around the world. So we've seen that with Zoran Mamdani in New York, Catherine Connolly in Ireland. There's plenty of other examples where, you know, there's these countercurrents that are forming to the kind of general rightward kind of shift that we've seen. And I guess the other element is to challenge the far right. You know, as you said before, the far right kind of put out these ideas that are then normalized by the major parties. So the role of the socialists and the left can be to challenge that and to try and shift politics towards the left as well, in a general sense. So yeah, there's plenty that. There's an important role for socialists to play in kind of stopping people from getting caught up in the far-right kind of manipulation and providing genuine solutions that actually get us out of the crisis that we're in.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Isaac, for being on our program. And I think, yeah, this has been a very good interview, kind of highlighting an important kind of left-wing kind of response to the rise of One Nation. Thanks again, Isaac, for being on our program. And, just want to encourage listeners to have a look at Isaac Nellis's article, How Labor is Paving the Way for One Nation, which is available to read on greenleft.org.au.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Isaac.
Yeah, it's called One Nation, but it's really a party that supports the dividing of a nation. And for listeners that just tuned in, we were just speaking with Isaac Nellis, who's an activist journalist with Green Left, and we're talking to him about how Labor is paving the way for the rise of support for One Nation. We're going to go to a quick break. Stay with us.
The state government has sold 578 hectares of public land to private developers. They're building private public partnership model housing over public housing land, and it's just not on.
Housing is just massively expensive. It's never been effective in this country to rely on the market to provide decent housing for people.
Rent has risen by 21%. That's median rent across the country as of January this year.
As the rents keep rising, so must we. And we must stand together as a collective, because this war cannot be won by the few. It will only be victorious by the many.
3CR. Stay tuned. Stay radical.
Hello, I'm Z the People from 47 Soul. You're listening to Palestine Remembered on 3CR Community Radio. Free Palestine.
CR, always bringing you the latest union news.
I guess I'm frustrated, thinking about all the places I should have been by now, and endlessly waiting, feel like the barrel of dynamite waiting for flame to come round. I need a little spark, a light amid a dark. I think I'm ready to go, I think I'm ready, I think I'm ready to go, I think I'm ready. And I'm out of the wind, so can
think I'm ready. I think I'm ready to go.
All right. Also,
it's part of the song.
Oh yeah, the song hadn't finished playing. Okay, you're just listening to Green Left Radio on Free CR 855 AM, and you're just listening to Ready by Montang. And I think it was quite appropriate to play Montang this morning because we actually had the pleasure of hearing her perform at the last Palestine rally on Sunday, where she is very much lending her voice and being one of the more outspoken people opposing Australia's participation in Eurovision, and very much calling on SBS to boycott Eurovision. So that's a bit of an ongoing campaign, especially since, like, at least I think 4 to 5 countries have withdrawn from Eurovision in protest of Israel's participation. Okay, now speaking of international solidarity with Palestine, I thought we'd draw on some news stories from the pages of Green Left, specifically focusing on some of the international developments that have happened in the past month. So one international development that I think is definitely kind of worthwhile looking at is basically Italian dock workers have kind of led a very powerful wave of international labor and civil society solidarity with Palestine, with, you know, striking dock workers leading protests from November 28th to November 29th. Unionized workers, community groups and environmental activists protested in 40 cities across Italy. They were also joined by protests across Europe, including in the Spanish state capital Madrid, in Portugal, France, Germany, Belgium, Norway, Luxembourg, Poland, Austria and Ireland. And at the same time, we were also seeing solidarity actions in South America with Mexico and in 4 cities across Brazil. In North America, we also saw protests in Montreal, Toronto in Canada, and in Chicago within the United States. So I think, while the Palestine movement, in light of this kind of fake ceasefire that's really much in place, the fact that we're still seeing continuous sort of protests and actions for Palestine, I think, are very inspiring. One of the things as well is that in Mulumbi and Newcastle, the environmental group Rising Tide joined forces with Palestine solidarity groups and 40 grassroots organisations with the Paddle Out for Palestine on November 29th, which was very much linked with this whole National Day of Action that took place, that was led by the Italian dock workers. And I think probably another thing to kind of highlight as well is the Italian protests were very much amplified by, you know, high-profile international figures who travelled to Genoa and Rome to stand alongside the striking dock workers. Among them were the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territories, Francesca Albanese, climate and pro-Palestine activist Greta Thunberg, former Greece Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis, and Chris Hedges, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. So yeah, I think this is definitely a good sort of positive kind of news story, and you can read more about it in the pages of Green Left, and the article is titled "Italian Workers Lead Global Action to End Genocide."
Very exciting, empowering story to see these protests, particularly in Italy. This was their third strike against Israel's genocide in Palestine, and it's representing a much larger force of power all these coordinated global actions at the dock, at the docks against Israel. And it's exactly what we need to be doing. Workers exercising their power to withdrawing their labour and shutting down this genocide.
Now, the next kind of story I want to sort of highlight is this is a report that was published in Green Left. And it is basically a report on the founding conference of the Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana-led party, which was known as Your Party, which took place in Liverpool over November the 29th to the 30th. So just to give a bit of report on what happened at the founding conference, the conference has ratified the name Your Party. So now Your Party is called War Party. I'm not the biggest fan of the name, but, you know, it is what it is. And, of course, the conference also decided that on a leadership structure, key constitutional provisions, and set a vision for the type of party that it wants to be. Now, just to give a bit of background on this, Your Party was announced in July when Sultana posted on X that she was leaving the Labour Party to form a new party with Corbyn and other independent MPs and activists across the country. Now, this party was broadly conceived to be a left alternative to the Labour Party within Britain, and very much seen as a force, and conceptualised as a force to challenge the rise of Nigel Farage's anti-immigration reform UK party, which has risen in the polls, and some analysis said in October it could hold the largest block of MPs in the House even if an election was held. And, of course, this is all in the context of the Keir Starmer government overseeing falling living standards, delayed promises to overturn anti-union laws, and has also openly backed Israel's genocide in Gaza. It has also refused to tackle reforms racism head-on and has hardened its policies around asylum seekers. Now, just to give a few reports on a few little different two elements that happen about Your Party. Now, there was a lot of when it comes to the kind of initial assignment, there was over 800,000 people had signed up to Your Party when it was kind of first announced. But one of the challenges is that the initial assignment has been impacted by months of infighting in the lead up to the conference between Zara and Corbyn. Two of the independent group of MPs involved in forming Your Party, Iqbal Muhammad and Adnan Hussain, left in the weeks before the conference. It was reported that Hussain said he quit because of Hussain quit because of persistent infighting and a struggle for power in the organisation, while Muhammad suggested false allegations and smears against him after he was accused of transphobia. Another kind of element that sort of happened in the conference is members of the Socialist Workers Party were expelled from Your Party on the eve of the conference, with Sultana boycotting the first day of the conference in solidarity with them. Now, how the conference sort of ended up happening was it was attended by over 2,500 delegates who were selected through an online sortition process, which involved randomly selecting people from the membership to act as delegates. Now, some of the positive things, I guess, that sort of came out of this, and, I mean, just another thing as well, is that probably one element about the initial assignment is a lot of people have also joined the Greens, which is now under the leadership of Zach Polanski, who has actually, I think, been very strong and quite outspoken in terms of putting forward kind of left-wing politics. So right now, the Greens Party actually in UK has actually grown to having over 170,000 members, which is actually quite significant. There's definitely a kind of rise of the left that we're definitely seeing, because Your Party still has over 50,000 members, and there's still potential to kind of grow from that. Now, a few things to report about another few elements to report about the conference. I mean, one of the kind of clear things about what the conference sort of outlined is, as kind of Corbyn kind of said at the conference, you know, we are here today to found a new democratic socialist party in Britain that can challenge power in society. And he said, we have an amazing opportunity before us. It is up to us to develop a mass party and a force that brings people in and gives people that sense of hope. We live in a world with the most gross levels of inequality imaginable, and our movement is one of justice, equality, and environmental sustainability. So just a few things to kind of end on. I mean, the conference decided on some key points. As I said, retaining the name Your Party, voted up a constitution, a founding political statement, standing orders and organising strategy. It also voted to allow dual membership with aligned political parties, likely reversing the SWP and other expulsions, and for a collective leadership model over a single elected leader. The collective leadership model includes a 20-person executive committee made of 16 elected members and 4 people who hold public office. And, of course, there'll also be, you know, the standard sort of office-bearer positions, including treasurer, secretary, spokesperson, political officer, chair, and deputy chair, who will oversee the day-to-day running of the party. So, yeah, that, I mean, overall, as someone who's sort of been following the developments of your party very closely, I mean, I was sort of a bit disheartened by some of the ridiculous sort of infighting that was sort of happening in the lead-up. But, I mean, there's still, I think, still quite a lot of potential. I mean, just a few points I'll sort of add that are not really in the article. I mean, one of the biggest challenges that your party is going to have, and there has been some attempts to build left parties that are to the left of Labor, and Respect was one of the earlier ones that, you know, actually had some initial success, but actually Respect had a lot more, had a lot of problems, specifically around a number of its lead candidate, George Galloway, who is actually still around in the political scene. I mean, George Galloway, you know, very much was a former Labor MP who sort of made a break from the Labor Party on an anti kind of war platform. And and he's still quite a controversial figure within the left, especially with his kind of quite socially conservative kind of views. But a few things to say is that one of the challenges that British politics has is, like, unlike a country like Australia, it does have a first-past-the-post system. So for a major left-wing party to really break, it really does have to have a size that reaches a certain particular mass. And I think, you know, a 57-member party is a good start, but, yeah, it does remain to kind of be seen. 55,000 members. Yeah. And probably one thing to kind of also note as well is, you know, yeah, it will kind of be remain to see how will they make a break in the electoral space. Especially since I think there is a lot of discussion about exploring electoral pacts with the Greens and other left wing forces. So, yeah. Anyway, I think at this point, though, I mean, it is the time in Britain with the Labour Party being on the nose. I mean, the Labour Party's actually level of support is actually currently lower than the Greens right now. Mm. But the more concerning thing is that the Tories and Reform have increased in support. So, yeah.
Yep.
A lot of political challenges ahead, but I think all the solidarity with the left trying to build a mass left force in Britain.
Mm. Well, we're going to go to a quick break and we'll be back with more Green Left Radio.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.
You're back listening to Green Left Radio, and we're going to play a song called Right Place, Wrong Time by Dean Lombard. Thank you.
fences are coming down. The soldiers are walking round. They're beating the men in the whole compound. The air is full of sounds. People strewn on the ground. They're smashing the phones. They're breaking the bones. They're grinding the people down. Who came to the right place at the wrong time? Nowhere to run, somewhere to die. In the right place at the wrong time. They're riling the people up. They're filling a bitter cup. They're spreading the fear to all I can hear. They're making the whole thing up. They're looking us in the eye. Or telling a pack of lies. They're hiding the boats. They're buying the votes with innocent people's lives. Who came to the right place at the wrong time? Nowhere to run, somewhere to die. In the right place at the wrong time.
You're back listening to Green Left Radio, and thanks to the Phosphenes for that track called Right Place, Wrong Time. It was written, they wrote it after the Manus Island Detention Centre was invaded by a violent mob after the Australian government closed and abandoned it in October 2017. And the inhumane treatment of refugees and asylum seekers by the Australian government in the 21st century was a stark contrast with the period up to the 1980s when Australia welcomed people fleeing violence and seeking a new life. The person who wrote it, Dean Lombard, said that he was reminded, they were reminded of this contrast regularly and would often ride their bike past the mural of former Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser, commissioned by members of the local Vietnamese community in appreciation for Australia accepting so many refugees from the Vietnam War. And we used to be the right place for people who needed a safe place to escape to, but not anymore.
Mm. Yeah. What a powerful song. And I couldn't help feeling it sort of had a bit of a Midnight Oil feel to it, didn't it? It was a little bit rocky. Yeah, look, we've had some unfortunate news. Unfortunately, Lara is unable to join us this morning to discuss the win with Techno Park. But hopefully we can get her on air next Friday. So we do apologise for that, listeners. But really encourage... If you have been following Techno Park, Techno Park is an affordable housing little estate of flats. And basically what had happened was that the council had told the residents, they'd given them eviction notices and told them that they had to leave due to their properties being in an industrial zone. And there was all of this kind of, yeah, just unnecessary stuff. Some of those residents have been living there since the 60s. It was absolutely ridiculous. And they had a victory. So if you have been following that and you want to learn more about that before we can get Lara back on air, I think there's been some good coverage by ABC on that one. That's a massive win for Techno Park residents. So I just want to congratulate them and just acknowledge all the hard work and campaigning and activism, and I know Lara's played a really big part in that, so yeah, well done.
Okay, so want to go into the Green Left activist calendar for the next 5 minutes. So first event I want to highlight is there is a Socialist Alliance end of year party going to be happening on Friday, December the 12th at
today.
at 5:30 p.m. at the Robinson Reserve, 104B Renard Street in Coburg.
Yeah.
And the other thing is there's going to be the annual Resistance Books store sale, which is going to be happening from Saturday, December the 13th, with the exception of Sunday. We won't be open. They won't be open on Sunday. But from Saturday to Saturday, December the 12th, the Resistance Centre will be open with 25% off everything. If you want to buy some books, buy some Christmas presents.
Great idea.
It'll be a great idea to come by. And at the Resistance Centre bookstore at level 5407 Swanson Street. Yeah.
Also badges and T-shirts and other things that you like, left-wing flags, messaging on it.
Yeah. Maybe keychains. Mm. And yeah, great way to sneakily radicalise your family and loved ones.
Yeah.
Now, there's just one thing I just want to highlight. This is like a month away. I mean, it's happening next year. Because you can say everything's next year now.
Oh, not that, Jake. It's too early for that, mate.
Basically, on Monday, January the 26th, there'll be the Invasion Day at 10 a.m. at the Parliament House of Victoria. I think it'll be very important this next year to have a big, massive mobilisation. I mean, given the recent Black Deaths in Custody report, but also the fact that the far right is attempting to mobilise on January 26th, and it will likely be quite a sizeable right-wing kind of protests. That said, I'm very confident our protests will be bigger, and I think it'll be very important to make our protest on Invasion Day to be as big as possible on January 26th. Just a few other events to highlight. There is going to be the rally, Hands Off Our State Library, at 12:30 at the State Library. But just a recent announcement, it looks like that in response to the kind of proposed State Library restructure, which would have meant the loss of jobs, I think that the State Library management has actually pulled back. But anyway, I think the protest should still be going ahead. Then there's going to be there's a number of LASNET events happening, including a webinar, US Hands Off Latin America at 11 a.m. There's going to be a public meeting, LASNET Building Solidarity with Latin America at 3 p.m. at the Catalyst Social Centre, 144 Sydney Road in Coburg. Then there also is going to be a few other important events, including a gathering for Gaza at 2 p.m. at the Port Melbourne Industrial Centre for the Arts. Yeah, I think those are probably all the events I want to highlight. But I think Steph had one event that she wanted to highlight.
Yeah, I just wanted to. there's an event coming up, which, you know, if you're interested in walking or running, like doing a bit of a fun run. So it's a fun run for mutual aid held on Sunday, the 1st of February, 9 a.m. start. And then 11 a.m. there'll be food and a raffle. And it's along the Maribyrnong River Trail, which is just gorgeous and is where I'm really fortunate to live. So I definitely wanted to promote this. And the really great thing is that the funds will be split evenly between First Nations, Palestinian and Sudanese initiatives. So it's free to join, sponsored to run. And then if you can't make this date or location, you complete your run anytime, anywhere. So please go to Instagram, Fun Run for Mutual Aid. And that's with a number 4. So at Fun Run for Mutual Aid. Yeah.
3CR. Maybe we'll go to another song.
Yes.
Phoebe Bridges and their song Savior Complex.
Thank you.
And welcome back to the studio. You're listening to the Green Left Radio Show. And what was that song again? Sorry, comrades.
Savior Complex by Phoebe Bridgers.
Yeah. From their album The Punisher, I think.
Yeah, gorgeous song. So we're just going to have a bit of a discussion actually around some very interrelated issues that have kind of come up. So I am referring to some different articles here from The Guardian and ABC. But, yeah, I just I found this stat just horrifying and just felt the need to share it with y'all. But there's been a report by the United Nations Global Environmental Outlook, and it was produced by 200 different researchers by the UN Environment Programme. And it is about the climate crisis, of course. And currently, and this is absolutely floored me, but food and fossil fuel production is causing $5 billion of environmental damage per hour. It's hard to even fathom that, but like, and obviously this report makes an urgent plea for emergency action on this. The way we are heading is completely unsustainable. So yes, it does talk about food production, especially around animal agriculture and how resource intensive and polluting that is. It talks about, of course, the use of fossil fuels, and just like I guess a lot of this isn't new information in some ways, but being able to put, given that we're in a capitalist world, being able to put a dollar figure, a monetary amount to the damage that's being caused, maybe that's something that will speak to governments. You know, if they won't do it out of, you know, care for human beings, maybe they'll do it with economic pressure. I don't know. We can only hope. Yeah, so the UN has made a statement on behalf of 28 different countries. We witnessed divergent attempts to question the scientific nature of this process. Our delegations fully respect every state's right to safeguard their country's national interests and rights, but science is not negotiable. And I think that is something that, you know, as socialists, like, we cannot... Yeah, and I guess, like, you know, from a Marxist perspective, we understand that the ruling class has absolutely a vested interest in maintaining the status quo and continuing on this complete annihilation of a livable planet for profit, which is just completely crazy. But, you know, unless the 99% really start to mobilise, nothing's going to be done. So while this report is an appeal to governments, obviously, and we can hope for, you know, some legislative changes, ultimately the climate movement needs to be grassroots and needs to be led by the 99%. We need system change, not just trying to contain climate change. We need a drastically different system to the one that we've got. And then there's a couple of other things that I wanted to mention as well, which have also been recent happenings that are really tie into this. So, I did check for updates, but it doesn't look like there's been any further news that I can see since. But unfortunately, there's been two very large bushfires raging in Perth, in Kenwick and Bullsbrook. Sorry, this is in Perth. Like, this isn't... it's not in the middle of nowhere. In suburbs of Kenwick, Wattle Grove, Upper Swan and Bullsbrook. So aerial crews are battling intense flames and the weather is, yeah, obviously very hot, as often happens in summer, but we know that there's a really big link there for climate change. So I'm just really thinking of all those poor, people over there who are, you know, probably in fear for their lives at the moment, worried about losing their properties, you know, loved ones, pets. We hope that everyone's able to stay safe and following the emergency updates on that one. But, yeah, it's just, it really speaks to, yeah, what we know is unfolding is the climate emergency. And then the other thing that's happened this week, very recently, is the Victorian government's now tendering out gas exploration plans in Gippsland and the Otways. And so I guess, like, and Jacob might have something to say to this, but, you know, around the Labor government's climate action, or they're actually doing so much to harm and to continue this trajectory of, climate destruction. And they're opening, new coal mines, more mining, more fossil fuel, rather than, you know, winding it back. It's just, it's so disheartening to read about this. But, you know, as socialists, we understand why this is happening. So with the onshore exploration in the Gippsland area, this is occurring near the 90 Mile Beach Marine National Park. Why the heck there would be any sort of gas exploration near a national park? Like, it's just completely inappropriate. And in Gippsland, this covers 199 square kilometres between Woodside and Seaspray on the coast. The government has invited private industry to tender for the new offshore and onshore reserves offering, and said it would prefer applications for the offshore zone that do not propose further seismic testing and rely on existing data. Oh, well, that's very nice of them, isn't it? Okay. And then the Victorian Energy Minister, D'Ambrosio? Yeah, I think that's right. Said the exploration of new gas was a necessary part of the state's energy transition. Yep.
It's horrifying.
A necessary part of the... There's no transition happening here, Lily. This isn't a transition. This is an expansion.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, just a few reflections to kind of add to this. Actually drawing on some of the experiences of attending Rising Tide. But we had actually heard from a Torres Strait Islander elder who's very much been, at the forefront of, you know, fighting for her land against climate destruction.
Yeah.
And one of the things that sort of struck me is... She was kind of quoted as kind of saying that scientists are basically saying that, like, the Torres Straits, and I'm just basing this on memory, so I can't completely 100% verify this, but it's probably within the realm of truth. But basically, you know, the kind of latest sort of research for the Torres Straits is that their land will likely be underwater in like 30 years time. Yeah. And I think the tragedy of that is very confronting when you look at how little governments are doing. And in fact, I was even struck by the fact that, well-known capitalist Bill Gates has now kind of changed his rhetoric recently to that, climate change is not actually the biggest issue. I mean, a lot of us will be fine. Fine as in himself and
in his ivory tower.
His fellow rich sort of capitalists.
Yeah.
The fact is the capitalist class is driving us to extinction, and they do not care about the human costs that will that will be disproportionately impacted. And I think what was even more insulting in relation to this and to this woman is that who spoke at Rising Tide is she was actually invited to be part of COMP, the climate United Nations Climate Change Conference that happened in Brazil. It happened in Brazil this year. That was great. You know, it's sort of like amazing that, you know, you have a conference that essentially brings all the world leaders essentially committing to doing absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
But then they'll tokenistically have some First Nations representation to kind of, so they can have a platform to kind of speak about the real issue of climate change and how it's impacting on the communities. Yeah. But they will, in fact, actually in reality, do absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
So it's actually the definition of tokenism.
100%.
You can't get any more insulting than that of how the capitalist class and the capitalist system treats the most marginalized and oppressed people in the world.
Well, not only that, they also, with the COP, they also locked out the First Nations Brazilians. Like, they wouldn't allow them.
They had a big protest
they
outside.
They did, which power to them. But yeah, the situation is dire. And so I guess, you know, in mentioning all of these articles, and I'm really, you know, if I get my act together, I may try and do a bit of a write-up on these, I think, because they're so, so interrelated. But we cannot forget, we are living in an emergency. We are living... the clock is literally ticking, and we need to mobilize. We need to build a mass climate movement. We cannot be complacent about this, because it's not, while we may not be immediately affected down here in Melbourne, in Nam, there's other parts of the world where it is literally a situation of life or death. Yeah. And the loss of so much culture, so much history, especially of places like the Torres Strait Islands, would be an absolute travesty for the traditional owners who've always lived there, but also for humanity as a whole and for all the animals and marine life and plants that that call those places home as well. We have a responsibility. So... yeah, sorry it's a bit grim, but I guess that the good news, I'm trying to find a positive spin because I'm a counsellor and I like to do a positive reframe now and then. But one thing I wanted to highlight based on the discussions that we've had today is that regardless of the oppression that we face, regardless of the numerous ways that the ruling class try to maintain power and control, solidarity is always stronger. Solidarity is always more powerful, and solidarity will always prevail. And so we've got to believe that, and we've got to make sure that we come together and organise ourselves and take action. Yeah. Well, it's been a really great program today. Yeah, sorry that we weren't able to have that interview with Lara about Technopark, but we will get her back on soon. And we've had a really some really good discussions, I think, today.
We want to thank our guest, Isaac Canellis, Green Left activist, journalist, and member of Socialist Alliance.
Yeah.
And you can read more about all the stories we talked about today, plus videos and detailed anti-capitalist analysis and even book and music reviews at greenleft.org.au. Please think about subscribing. Keep it independent. It's only $5, or as little as $5 a month. Anything else Jacob or Steph wants to say before we introduce the next show, which is Left After Breakfast?
No, I don't think I have anything more to add. I think it's been a great program this week. It's very good to be back on as well.
Yeah, it is nice to have you back, Jacob. And also really lovely to have Chloe on air again as well. So, yeah, thanks, comrades. Thank you, listeners. Make sure you keep listening to Left After Breakfast and look at some of the other programs that 3CR offers. There's lots of really, really good stuff here.
This brings us to the end of the show. You have been listening to Friday Morning Breakfast with Green Left Radio, brought to you by Green Left Weekly Newspaper, which brings an alternative source of information that puts people and planet before profit.
If you like our work, become a supporter from $5 per month at greenleft.org.au/support or free call 1-800-634-206.
Arise, you workers from your slumbers. Arise, you prisoners of want. For reason in revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of Khan. Away with all your superstitions, serve all masses,
arise!
We'll change henceforth the old tradition and spurn the dust to win the prize. That's right, the commies are back. Reds underneath your beds in that crack.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.